Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Do you have an insecurity that you hide from the world? Something really personal and intimate? In his new short story collection, the actor and now also author Jesse Eisenberg imagines a school bully who's researched his victims especially so that he can tap in to those emotional weak spots. I wonder what a bully who did his research would pick on about you.
It would be more than four pages. Oh, goodness gracious. I was not prepared for this, and I don't mean in this interview. I was not existentially prepared for this question.
He's going to dig deep, though, and he's going to tell us it's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Jesse Eisenberg about writing, anxiety, and getting that first break.
It's the difference, really, in a way, like when I think about writing something, it's the difference between the blank page and page one, which is a much bigger difference than page one and page 100. Because once you have page one, it's everything. It's a context, it's a tone, it's everything. And once you're in a movie that people see and gives you some notice, it creates a kind of platform to be able to have a career.
Then later, I'll talk to Brian Regan, one of the all-time greats of stand-up comedy, about his new special. He might be the most famous stand-up in the United States who's famous for his stand-up. He's never had a TV show. It might be because the meetings don't always go that great.
Sometimes, you know, when you go into these network meetings and stuff like that, they're not really familiar with me or my comedy. They just feel like, all right, you've gotten to this point, and now we'll take over from here, chuckles. And I've always been resistant to that. You know, it's like, well, I want to be at the table deciding what we're going to do.
Brian Regan Live will be the first live-to-air stand-up comedy special on Comedy Central. So I guess Brian's going to be well and truly at the table for that one. Plus, the musician Sarah Watkins will introduce us to the song that makes her feel ferocious. And I'll tell you about the funky disco fusion of Hugh Masekela. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. I'm Jesse Thorne. This is Bullseye. Jesse Eisenberg started acting as a kid. Since then, he has starred in a whole pile of movies, including The Social Network, Zombieland, To Roam With Love, and the upcoming Batman vs. Superman. What most people probably don't know about him yet is that he's also a playwright and a short story writer. His new book of comic short fiction is called Bream Gives Me Hiccups. The title refers to a series of restaurant reviews written from the perspective of a privileged 9-year-old with divorced parents. The book includes riffs on Alexander Graham Bell bungling his first phone calls, high school angst. Frankly, there is a lot of anxiety and neurosis on display. Jesse Eisenberg, it is so great to have you on Bullseye. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jesse, which is the first time I'm able to thank myself without being accused of arrogance.
So I want to ask you, first of all, you became a professional actor at a young age. How old were you when you started going out on auditions for things?
I did like children's theater in my town in New Jersey when I was about 8 years old. But really like auditioning for things in New York City, I think I was like 14.
Well, now tell me like why and how.
Initially I wanted to perform in the local children's theater because my sister was there, and I just wanted to do what she was doing because she's 3 years older. And anything she did, I did. Then I really started to hate school, and theater became kind of like not only a kind of like emotional outlet and another interest, but like a literal one too. I was able to like leave school to go audition for things when I was 14. If I got into a play, which I did when I was that age, I got to leave early on Wednesdays because there was like a Wednesday matinee. I was understudying in plays too, so I didn't actually have to do anything. I just had to leave school and go sit backstage with other understudies. So it was kind of the perfect situation. I didn't have to do the nerve-wracking acting bit on stage, and I didn't have to be in school.
What did you hate about school?
I don't know. I wasn't like actually really like bullied. I never had like a real story where I can go home and say, I hate school because of this particular thing. I just really felt out of place and nervous and homesick. I think it probably a lot of kids feel that way. And a lot of kids probably don't have like a specific thing to say that went terribly wrong. You know, I was never like beat up or bullied. I wasn't really even picked on. I was probably, if anything, just overlooked. That's probably most kids' experiences who hate school, you know, not being, you know, bullied or tortured or stuffed in a locker, but kind of just being overlooked and not feeling, you know, in your element. I was really, it was like kind of profoundly sad. I really was very sad, but with nothing to kind of specific to complain about.
Did you feel as socially alienated in the context of the theater as you did at school?
No, I didn't. I think partly because in school it felt like this absurd thing, like we're all united just based on age and location. And I think as a kid, I think I was just like very consciously aware that that was an unreliable joining criteria. Like, and then in the theater, it was the exact opposite. It felt like we were all there for this kind of absurd thing, like we're going to perform on stage, or in the case of the understudies, we're going to sit back and hope somebody gets sick on stage. And then there was this kind of cross-cultural, cross-generational grouping. So it we were grouped based on a shared interest rather than a location and age. And I think just by virtue of that, and by virtue of me knowing my place, like I'm an understudy, which means I can talk to this person and this person and this person because they're also understudies, and I can't talk to this person because he's actually in the show. I think that kind of specific delineation of hierarchy made me comfortable.
I was hoping you could read something from your new book. And my guest is Jesse Eisenberg, and his new book is called Bream Gives Me Hiccups and Other Stories. And it's sort of school related. It's a piece wherein a bully does his bullying with
precision insults.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
This is called A Bully Does His Research. Well, well, well. If it isn't little Tommy, give me your lunch money, dweeb. Hand it over. What? Are you scared? Are you worried about your family's financial situation now that your parents are separated? Well, boo-hoo-hoo. You probably think it's your fault, don't you? And even though your mommy told you that it had nothing to do with you, that you didn't make daddy fall in love with his hygienist and run away to that ashram in Oregon, it still feels unsettling. You lie awake, telling yourself, if I had just loved them more, if I had just gotten better grades or was nicer to grandma when she was in the hospital after her stroke in November, they would still be together. And now you have to give me the money your mother gives you every morning because she can't pack a bag lunch since her insomnia and reliance on Ambien makes her too groggy. Well, cry me a river. Well, 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 if it isn't Mr. Selowitz, the science teacher, catching me in the act of stealing little Tommy's lunch money. Well, Smellowitz, smell this. I'm not Claude Monet. Yeah, that's right. I know you're threatened by me, but unconsciously associating me with Monet's not going to help. Yeah, I know you wanted to go to RISD since you were my age, but you couldn't get in, and now you're stuck teaching sixth grade science. Well, boo-hoo-hoo. You probably thought you were the future of impressionistic painting, doing your high school art project on a postmodern take on Monet's water lilies, with real lilies mounted in a 3D diorama inside a tank of water. Well, guess what? It wasn't good enough for RISD, and it's certainly not good enough for your stepfather, Aaron Segura, the beloved art critic who never liked your work to begin with. Sorry, Teach. Well, 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 if it isn't Principal O'Malley, here to suspend me for stealing little Tommy's lunch money and talking back to Mr. Selowitz. I bet it feels good punishing me, right? Lording your limited power over an adolescent bully makes you feel big and strong, doesn't it? Especially since I have such a nice head of hair, and you started experiencing rapid male pattern baldness when you were only 16 years old. Well, boo-hoo-hoo. You tried everything, didn't you? First the natural remedies, because you were too embarrassed to tell your doctor that you were going bald and couldn't afford a prescription for anything that would actually work. So you tried eating sardines every day for a year in the faint hope that it would help. And then, by the time you could afford Propecia, it was too late because your hairline had already receded, and Propecia has little success of actually regrowing hair shafts, from dead follicles, especially in the temporal lobe region, where you are most explicitly affected. Suck it. Well, well, well. If it isn't my father, here to pick me up from school after I was suspended for stealing little Tommy's lunch money, talking back to Mr. Selowitz, and showing Principal O'Malley that his need for power is rooted in unresolved trauma related to his early male pattern baldness. Thanks for the ride home, Pops. Is it weird to pick me up in the middle of the day, or does it highlight the fact that Mom's the one with the real job? Does it reconfirm, in some conscious or even unconscious way, that you've lost all sense of pride and masculinity? Did it initially seem interesting to have Mom keep her job at the law firm while you stay home and raise the kids? Did you brag to all your friends that you were proud to be eschewing gender norms? Well, boo-hoo-hoo. I bet you feel a burning sense to go out into the world and get even the most menial job just to feel like a person again, once you realize the novel you thought you'd write with your new free time wasn't ever going to materialize, and that you'd be stuck walking around the house in dirty sweatpants, looking at the clock and waiting for the woman you used to know to come back home with the bacon. Psych. Well, well, well. If it isn't the town bully, grounded in his bedroom, looking in the mirror and questioning his behavior, after stealing little Tommy's lunch money, talking back to Mr. Selowitz, revealing Principal O'Malley's inner demons, and emasculating his father. So, has it really come to this? A cliched moment of self-reflection from the hardened aggressor? Well, boo-hoo-hoo. You probably think that endlessly harassing people with your well-detailed and overly analytical personal criticisms will make you feel better. You probably think you can keep everyone at a safe emotional distance if you can put everyone down. You probably think that if no one can get close to you and you remain hardened against the world, you'll never get hurt. That if no one likes you, you could remain in a safe little bubble. Bite me.
Jesse Eisenberg, reading from Bream Gives Me Hiccups and Other Stories, his new book. Jesse, I hope you'll forgive me for asking such a thuddingly obvious question, but...
I'll probably give you a thuddingly obvious answer.
I wonder what a bully who did his research would pick on about you.
It would be more than four pages. Oh, goodness gracious. I was not prepared for this, and I don't mean in this interview. I was not existentially prepared for this question. what would he be? What, you're asking me to, like, kind of list my best flaws? My biggest flaws? Best flaws already.
Least the flaws that you are most worried about. I mean, I don't think that bullying is necessarily about what are the actual worst things about you. But it's
right.
More about the things that you are most sensitive about or worried about.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm sitting here in a studio at NPR, and the book that's sitting there are two books sitting on the counter here. One is my book, which took me years to write I wrote it over the course of years. And the book that's sitting next to me is a book called The Ottoman Endgame. I'm just going to take it here and look through for a second. So it is 535 pages. It details war, revolution, and the making of the modern Middle East from 1908 to 1923. Now, I am new to the literary world, and, you know, I think, wow, I spent a lot of time on this book. It's funny. I've done readings of it. It's good. I like it. It's got nice reviews. And yet, I kind of step into the NPR studio, and sitting here is a 535-page book about the called The Ottoman Endgame. And I guess I feel... a bit like an interloper in this world, you know? I kind of feel like I've been successful in other media, and so I can kind of parlay that in some way, even if my book is as good as the other books that come out, into some kind of, like, attention in this, into this realm. And I feel it a little strange sometimes, and especially when I'm sitting next to a 535-page book about the Ottoman Endgame, which probably will have a more difficult time getting press than my book, just by virtue of me being in movies and that being about the Ottoman Empire in 1908. So, yeah, I guess that's something I feel quite self-conscious about, especially doing stuff related to my book. It doesn't mean I don't think the book is good. I think the book is really good. I love reading it. It's my favorite thing. I wrote a thing that I would like to read. But that's what I feel probably most self-conscious about right now.
Do you enjoy performing?
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I love it. I mean, I'm about to start a movie that I didn't write, a Woody Allen movie. But I love that just as much as performing the things I did write. I don't see kind of a real distinction.
What do you enjoy about it?
I always, you know, I ride the subway and I have this distinct sense that most of the people on the train would love to start weeping. Not because their lives are miserable, just because I think we all kind of carry the burden of, you know, we just carry this existential burden, which sounds pretentious, but I think it's true. I think it's like, you know, we all carry these things that we kind of bottle up and, you know, just we can get on with our day. So we tell each other kind of, we tell each other white lies so we don't offend each other. And we smile and we say, you know, how you doing? Good. Instead of saying, how you doing? And waiting for the person to actually tell us, which is fine because that's the way we kind of interact so that the days can go on and that we can do things and, you know, not just, you know, sit around crying. But I do feel like performing allows me to get all that stuff out in a safe context. It's, I guess, been written about in a way and probably is referred to as something like the therapeutic power of theater. And it's not just for the performers, but I just finished a play that I wrote and we did it for several months. And, you know, you walk out after and people are experiencing real emotions, you know, during the play. And you walk out after and you see that and they express that to you. I think there's something really healthy about that. I wish theater was more accessible so that more people can have that. We had student groups come and, you know, we try to do what we can. But I think there's a really kind of therapeutic power in experiencing emotions in a room with people, which is why I think people still read, and I think it's why people still go to movies in the way they do. It seems like irrational to go watch something fictional and to cry during it as though it's real. But I think we do it because it really evokes something that we want to have evoked.
When you're experiencing emotion as a performer, how is it similar or different to the experiences that you have as a consumer of media, as a reader or as a watcher of films or television or whatever?
I was once with a friend. I was 18 years old. He was a piano player. He had just started at the Manhattan School of Music, and he was a great pianist. And I asked him, could you play me something that you're working on? And he played me this incredible piece, and he was kind of just sitting there while playing it with no emotion in his face. And to me, it was this incredible experience just listening to this really dramatic, you know, piano piece. And I said to him after, you know, that was very moving for me. Did you feel anything? And he was like, well, yeah, I was playing it. I said, I know, but I was hearing it. He said, whatever you're hearing and experiencing, I, as the player, am feeling it 10 times more. I said, oh, my goodness, really? He said, yes. I said, oh, my God, I think actually that's how I feel as an actor. Like, I feel a lot of these things. You know, it's fictional, but you're bringing your own emotions to it. There's no way around that. And or if there is a way around it, I haven't learned it. And I think as an audience member, you're feeling it too. But it's been my experience that the actors and the really good ones that really kind of invest their own emotions into their performances are feeling it more.
I want to play a clip from a movie that you were in. It came out last year called The Double, which I really liked. And
oh, thanks.
It's a bit of a difficult film to explain, but it's a very stylized film sort of set in a vaguely futuristic world in the way that a Lynch movie or a Brazil or something like that is set in a vaguely futuristic world. And you play a character named Simon who sort of meets a doppelganger at his work.
Right.
It's not immediately entirely clear whether this doppelganger is a, you know, whether it's something that's literally happening in the world or something that's happening with his own mind or whatever. But anyway, I want to play this scene. So Simon is sitting down with James, who's his new coworker and looks exactly like him. Both of them are played by you, but right, they're completely different in their manner.
Right.
Simon is sort of jumpy and nervous and passive, and James is really confident and swaggery, and we hear Simon first in this scene.
What do you want to go? Okay, no, sorry, then. I'll just have a Coke and a bagel.
We're out of bagels.
Oh, right, then, right, then I'll just...
Come on.
Right, sorry, I just... I'll just have the Coke then, I guess.
A Coke. And you?
A coffee.
A coffee.
And scrambled eggs.
You don't serve breakfast in the evening?
Why not?
Because it says so on the menu.
Well, do you still have eggs here?
Yeah.
And do you have a frying pan?
Yeah.
Then do me a favor and make me some scrambled eggs.
Fine. Anything else?
Bacon.
Bacon.
And toast.
And toast.
And a beer.
And a beer. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Are you sure?
Just give me the damn food.
In conversation, you are not nearly as halting and timid as Simon, but there's more Simon than there is James in your natural mode of communication.
That's true.
What's it like to inhabit a character who is as sort of clear and forceful in the world?
It's great. It's like, you know, it's like the kind of like, you know, everybody has that fantasy that they would walk into their boss's office and tell him what they really think. You know, it's, you get to do that, but in a kind of safe context, not only in a safe context, but as part of your job. It's just, it's the greatest thing. I think that's probably why people do that kind of boss exercise in group therapy situations, because it's such a cathartic experience. And if you could do it in a kind of safe context, you can really release and exorcise, you know, that kind of that aggression that we probably all have and that we all bury because it's inappropriate to do it in, you know, normal interaction.
I'll continue my conversation with Jesse Eisenberg after a break. We'll talk about his upcoming role as Lex Luthor in the new Batman versus Superman movie and how he's dealt with his own social anxieties. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hi, I'm Lisa Hanawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller. And if you're not listening to our podcast, Baby Geniuses, you're missing out on stuff like
Kumail Nanjiani solving the Zodiac murders.
Who's like, would you ever go to a friend and you're like, hey, could you lick all these envelopes for me? You'd be like, you're a serial killer. I'm leaving right now.
Guy Branum talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And it was just a great moment of like, oh no, I'm here, boys. Like, I'm on this side of the bench.
Megan Amram talking about intimidating baristas.
Just feel like they're always in character. Like, they're always in character as, like, cool hipster girl. Mm-hmm. And I just want to break through that barrier.
Plus, every week we explore a new Wikipedia page and talk to a crazy expert in the field of nonsense.
Well, any hack can make you not have a boner. I mean, it's about how you do it.
Right.
You
know?
And we're the only podcast with regular updates about Martha Stewart's pony or your money back.
We're not going to give them their money back, are we?
No.
Let's keep it.
Yeah.
Listen to our show every other Monday on Maximum Fun.
Yay!
Yay!
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Jesse Eisenberg. He's an Academy Award-nominated actor and just published his first book of short fiction, which is called Bream Gives Me Hiccups. Your first big film was when you were, what, like 19 or something, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What was that experience like for you to be... I mean, it's one thing to be, you know, to be acting on stage and so on and so forth, or to have a little part in something or be in a commercial or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to be the star of a reasonably critically acclaimed and successful film, you know, a small one, but a big small one.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, that's, you know, when actors talk about luck, that's what they're referring to, is that there is this, you know, you could do a play and be the greatest actor in the world, and if it's not a good play or if not that many people see it, it ends up becoming kind of like, it feels oftentimes meaningless in terms of the trajectory of a career. Conversely, you could be fine in something, but it's popular, it's well received, the camera for some reason framed you in a way that made you look dramatic or something, and be very well received. That doesn't necessarily often lead to a career longevity. But for me, yeah, I was 19 years old and I was in this movie, Roger Dodger, and it was a small New York movie, but it was the kind of movie that people who make movies see. So it's good for, you know, it's good for an actor to, it's great exposure. And to me, I just felt so lucky. It was the difference between having an acting career that I could, you know, realistically pursue. It's the difference really in a way, like when I think about writing something, it's the difference between the blank page and page one, which is a much bigger difference than page one and page 100. Because once you have page one, it's everything. It's a context, it's a tone, it's everything. And once you're in a movie that people see and gives you some notice, it creates a kind of platform to be able to have a career, and then what you do after that and how you treat it and how hard you work and the you know, hopefully other kind of lucky breaks along the way is what keeps it sustainable.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Roger Dodger, which starred my guest Jesse Eisenberg when he was still a teenager. He plays a guy named Nick who goes to stay with his uncle Roger in New York City. And his hope is that his uncle will, like, teach him to be a smooth grown-up who, you know, can meet women and that kind of thing. The uncle is played by Campbell Scott. And in this scene, they're in a bar and they're hanging out waiting for two women to join them at the table.
So, how often do you, like, you know, like get somebody to go home with you?
Every night. Just because you're not having sex, Nick, doesn't mean the rest of us are sitting around playing cribbage.
What's cribbage? What?
Here we go.
If they come, this is so stupid. They're like twice my age.
Champions refuse to lose. Be like Mike.
Here we are, as promised, for one drink. I'm Andrea, and this is Sophie.
I'm Roger. This is my nephew, Nick.
Hey. He really is like 16. I told you.
Sit down.
How'd you get in here, Nick?
It's funny. You should, answer that, because, we were before we were discussing it, and...
Never you mind.
It seems like you have had experiences in films with really different tones. I mean, there's so much difference between the tone of, I'm just thinking of movies of yours that I've seen that I really liked, you know, like the difference between The Double and The Social Network and Adventureland, you know, that's three wildly different versions of representing reality, you know, none of which are about, you know, none of which are necessarily about, whatever our idea of naturalism is.
Yeah, that's right. But they're all kind of, they're all honest to the kind of context with which they've established themselves, you know, and that's the only really important thing, is that the kind of the contract that is set up between the product and the audience is honored, so that, you know, if you set up a movie like The Double and it's very unusual world, or even a movie that I was in like Zombieland, which is like this heightened kind of comedy in this post-apocalyptic world, if you set up the rules of that world, then you have to honor them, and that makes all of those movies really good, because they kind of stick to their word. Those movies don't have to necessarily represent the human experience in the way that the viewers experience the human experience, but they represent a kind of consistent portrait of something. And in doing so, well, it's like what George Bernard Shaw said, you know, if you write, or F. Scott Fitzgerald, I knew somebody with three names, you know, if you write about yourself, you write about the whole world. And that's what those things do. They're kind of true to themselves, and they're therefore maybe relevant to the entirety of the human experience.
Do you worry about the amount of yourself that you, and sort of control over your own identity, you give up to a huge audience when you do something for a huge audience? I mean, I think about, like, you're supposed to be in a Superman movie, right? And I don't know where that is along the timeline, but it's a thing that you're going to be Lex Luthor in a Superman movie, right?
Right.
And, like, that is something the scale of which is so gargantuan that I can barely even wrap my head around it. And it's something that, you know, I know people who've, you know, I have a friend, Glenn Whelan, who wrote an entire book about Superman, dedicated years of his life to this thing. And he is not unusual in his dedication to this world, you know.
That's true.
The thought of it intimidates me.
Oh, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe there's something intimidating if I were to really try to figure out what that was, but there's nothing I can do to, you know, the best thing I could do is to try to act well, right? And then, you know, hopefully the other pieces are in place, which they are. The writer, Chris Terrio, is incredible. One of the best scripts I've read, is really great. He wrote this incredible script with really sophisticated philosophical ideas at the heart of an exciting movie. And Zack Snyder is a visual master. And so I'm proud to be a part of that. In terms of the personal exposure, I guess it's uncomfortable in a lot of ways, but I don't know what the alternative would be. I mean, the alternative, frankly, would be to not do it. And when I weigh the things out, it doesn't even register on the scale, the idea of not doing it. It's an amazing role in and of itself. If it was the last role I did, I would still be satisfied with it. But by virtue of it being so popular and by virtue of it being a great role, it'll give me other opportunities to continue doing what I like doing. So, I mean, there's no amount of counterweight that would steer me clear of it.
There's a series of stories in your book that give it its title, The Bream Gives Me Hiccups, that are essentially stories from the perspective of this kid about his family falling apart that are in the form of restaurant reviews or at least meal reviews.
Right.
And it's so they're so sweet and heartbreaking in addition to being very funny. And I don't know. I wondered if all of these kids who were standing on shaky ground that are in this book came from your experience. And more than that, I think I wondered, like, whether you feel like as an adult, the ground underneath you is more stable.
My parents are married and good people. So this is not my specific experience, but it's a world I live in and a world I see. It's a world a lot of people live in, and unfortunately, too many people live in, coming from broken families. And it's something that I think I could realistically convey with humor and sadness, and maybe some kind of.
I mean, Jesse, in some way, like, yeah. It's not to my mind about the specific circumstances, not necessarily mm-hmm. about parents being divorced, but more about that feeling when you are a kid that you are not sure that you are able to figure out how things work in the world, and the sort of fear that comes with that. I mean, that is shot through a lot of the pieces in the book.
You feel like this, I think a lot of people who feel like they're kind of on the outside of a lot of social situations feel, this kind of, this feeling of real inferiority, a real feeling of, I am absolutely the worst person in this room. And then with that comes a little bit of, just instinctively the flip side of that, which is I feel like no one understands what's actually going on here, and I do. And I think that's probably the kind of the strange dichotomy that a lot of people who feel like kind of on the outskirts of normal socialization feel. And so that's what I write about. That's what I feel. And I think probably I imagine that's what a lot of people feel, even if they appear confident, because I probably appear, confident. Probably a lot of people appear happy and confident and are having that, that kind of deep, that profound feeling of being out of place. And even if you don't typically feel that, you probably have had experiences that make you feel that way. I think that's the human, experience, as I imagine. And so that's what I write about. And I think that's what I can absolutely relate to, especially as, the first stories are about a 9-year-old, other stories about people my age. But as a kid, that's certainly how I felt.
Do you feel less like that now as an adult? Or
no, I think
do you
I have,
feel like it's the same?
I have all those same feelings, but you have kind of more history and more evidence to indicate otherwise. So it's a little easier to kind of, look at the past and say, oh, right, I don't need to feel that way because I felt that way November 17th, 2006, and the thing I was worried about didn't come true.
What are you, Mary Lou Henner?
Yes, exactly. I was wearing my red shirt and eating. Yeah. So
Judd Hirsch was saying that he had just gone to see.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. That's really funny. So that's helpful. That's certainly helpful. The feelings don't go away because the feelings are like a core set of a core brain wiring. That doesn't go away. The only thing that goes away is the kind of length at which you feel those feelings, because in the past you wouldn't be able to look back and say, oh, right, the world didn't collapse.
Well, Jesse Eisenberg, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise, Jesse. Thank you so much for having me.
Jesse Eisenberg's new book is called Bream Gives Me Hiccups and Other Stories. He's also in a broad variety of movies that you can watch at a movie theater or at home on your TV. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Sarah Watkins is a fiddle player and singer who works as a solo artist and with the Watkins Family Hour. The Watkins Family Hour is a bit of a musicians' collective, anchored by Sarah and her brother Sean. Sarah and Sean played for many years with the group Nickel Creek. This is Early Morning Rain from the Watkins Family Hour's debut record. No place to go. Out on runway number 9. The Watkins Family Hour is also a variety show every month in L.A., trying out new material, bringing in new musicians. So when we asked Sarah to talk about a song that changed her life, it made sense that it was something that captured that feeling of a live show.
My name is Sarah Watkins, and I chose What Makes You Think You're the One, a Fleetwood Mac song off of Tusk.
It came to her just when she needed it most. She was in her early 20s, and she heard a cover of a song performed live by an L.A.-based musician named John Bryan.
John Bryan was doing one of his solo nights, and he sang the song with a fury, and it was just so powerful, and I hadn't heard Tusk at all. And I went and got this record.
She ended up listening to Fleetwood Mac's version over and over.
That song just became really important to me. This song, like, and I still go to it at these times where I just feel like I want to erupt the way that every hit of the snare is on this, you know. It sounds almost like a drum is falling downstairs. It's just... It just sounds reactive, and it's not careful, and it's not cautious. It's just somebody responding to the attitude of this song and to the lyric and the way Lindsay's singing it. Those drums were recorded with an old cassette player just stuck underneath the snare drum because of the compression and the way that it comes through that little cheap microphone made it sound just kind of tough and mighty, and it's just so fun. I think at the time I was in my early 20s and I was starting to be dissatisfied with the way that I was interfacing with the world. I felt like my patterns of behavior weren't necessarily linked up to how I felt about myself inside. And I think I wanted to be more aggressive and I wanted to feel like I represented myself with strength. And I wasn't sure how to do that. I remember a specific time when I went to this song for a reason, many, many times, like days and days in a row. We were working in the studio in the early 2000s, and I would pull up to the studio and just sit there and play this song and crank it till I hurt my ears. And I just remember singing along with it and air drumming along with it and just feeling like this song was coming out of me. And it felt like I had a teammate, like an emotional teammate at that time, to be able to have this song that was performed so ferociously, and I wanted to be ferocious. I wanted to have that. I felt like this song was mine. I would take it with me, and I had this almost strength. For me, whenever I feel a change coming, when I have something new to say, it's because I've been stagnant and I get really sick of it and you have to churn it up, and that turbulence is required for movement. And that turbulence, I think, is the thing that I felt happening when I was listening to this song. To it today, I notice how sparse it is. And when I listened to it back then, it just seemed fierce and relentless, and it is. It still is, but it's funny how when you need something to be something, it can really stand up to it.
Sarah Watkins on the song that changed her life, What Makes You Think You're the One, by Fleetwood Mac. Her group, The Watkins Family Hour, has a new self-titled record out. You can find them at watkinsfamilyhour.com. After a break, I'll talk to Brian Regan about his new stand-up special, Brian Regan Live. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Ty is a pedantic person. I think when he pronounces these words, it's in a very show-offy way. Gyro.
Gyro.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu.
Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with real cases. They call in via Skype to Judge John Hodgman's court, the real people's court. Now I call you to Judge John Hodgman's internet court. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Ask 100 comedians who the best in the business are. And there are folks that you know will end up with, you know, dozens of votes. Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld, Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman. But I'll bet dollars to donuts that number one on that list, the one comic who unites everyone, is Brian Regan. 100 comedians out of 100 love Brian Regan. He works clean, he does observational stuff, and he can destroy any audience. Any audience. Showtime at the Apollo, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, a research facility in Antarctica. It doesn't matter. He will get his laughs. Regan's probably the most famous comic in the United States who's actually famous for doing stand-up comedy. He has all of 3 acting credits on his IMDb page, one of which is just him doing material on Dr. Katz, so it sort of doesn't count. Regan travels the country filling theaters on the strength of his stand-up and his stand-up alone. Here he is on his last of more than 20 appearances on The Late Show with David Letterman.
I always love whenever there's a best of 7 series, because then I get to hear my favorite sports reporter question. Would you consider this a must-win game? You know, they always feel like they have to say yes. Yeah, we want to win it. It's very important, you know. Got our uniforms on anyway, might as well try. But it's not always the right answer, man. It's a math question. I wish I would answer that question honestly. It's a best of 7. You're down 1 game to nothing. Would you consider this a must-win game? No. No, we can lose tonight. We can lose tomorrow night, too. We don't want to, but that wasn't your question. You asked if it was a must-win game, and if you'd ever taken a rudimentary math class, you'd already know the magic number's 3. When you're down 3, then you must win them or you're out.
His new stand-up special will air live on Comedy Central on September 26th. Brian Regan, it's great to finally have you on Bullseye. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you, Jesse. I appreciate that.
So, Brian, this is a question I want to ask you about your career, and I don't want it to seem impertinent, but how much of the fact that your career is so focused on stand-up comedy is about you just wanting to do stand-up comedy? And how much is it about other non-stand-up comedy parts of the entertainment industry wanting you to focus on stand-up comedy?
Well, a little of both. I love stand-up comedy. I like it as an end result. That doesn't mean I wouldn't want to occasionally venture off and do some other stuff. But, you know, I always wanted to be careful if I did venture off that it was in a territory that I felt was conducive to my comedy, you know. Like, I'm not interested in being a celebrity or a star. You know, that stuff just doesn't jazz me. I would love to do a TV show, but it would have to be about my comedy. And sometimes, you know, when you go into these network meetings and stuff like that, they're not really familiar with me or my comedy. They just feel like, all right, you've gotten to this point, and now we'll take over from here, Chuckles. And And I've always been resistant to that. You know, it's like, well, I want to be at the table deciding what we're going to do. And so, you know, because it's been a little frustrating on the network side trying to get a network to agree with me that they should let me do what I want and leave me alone. And also the fact that I love stand-up comedy and don't want to give up on that either. I mean, I want to do that forever. I've just kind of stayed in the stand-up comedy camp.
I sort of picture these executives, you know, network TV executives in a sitcom meeting, like watching an hour of your stand-up and thinking, oh, man, we better tell this lovable doofus what's funny.
Yeah, or they don't even watch an hour of it. You know, I went into a meeting one time and I saw a tape of mine, like in the, you know, the outport little thing that comes out. And I realized whoever this is just watched 5 minutes of me 5 minutes ago. You know what I mean? So anyway, I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. It's just a different world out there in Hollywood. You know, they do things the way they want to do them, and it's not necessarily how I want to do them. So that's one thing I love about stand-up is that I'm autonomous. You know, I get to make the decisions. If I think I want to try something on stage, I don't have to run it by anybody. You know, I don't have to sit down with a group of people in suits and ties and say, what do you think? I love being able to just make the choices. You know, I'm just kind of biding my time waiting for somebody to say, hey, man, what do you want to do? So we'll see. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. That's fine.
You know, you have control over the product. You don't have control over the reactions. And, like, stand-up is one of the things where there's the most, you know, there's the most relationship between being successful and this, like, direct feedback, which is, did people laugh?
Right.
And I imagine that it's hard when you do something, especially if it's something that you like or you are proud of, and it doesn't generate that reaction that means success, and it's just you standing there.
Yes, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, I think comedy, you can look at it from a number of different angles. You know, you can look at it, you know, as if it's an art form, but you can also look at it as a science, you know, and I'm very intrigued with laughter and what makes people laugh. Sometimes I think, you know, this notion of what's funny and what isn't funny, I've settled on this philosophy. I think if one person in the world thinks something is funny, then it's funny. You know, now it might not be funny to everybody. In fact, it might only be funny to that person. So, like, if I, as a stand-up comedian, think of something and I think it's funny, I think it's funny. Now, it is funny. Now, it might not be funny enough to end up in my act. I mean, I do have a job, and I need audiences to agree with me for me to have a career, you know? So, you know, what happens is I'll think of 10 things that are funny. I try all of them on stage. The audience agrees with 3 of them, or 4 of them, or 1 of them, or 0 of them. The ones that they agree on become my act, you know, and you end up letting the stuff that you think is funny that they're not also agreeing with fall by the wayside. But, you know, you hear people flippantly make decisions on what's funny and what isn't. And what's weird to me is it's always whatever that person's sense of humor is. Everybody thinks their sense of humor is the correct one. They think that they're wired into Grand Central on what's funny. So if somebody watches a TV show, they go into work the next day and go, that show last night is not funny. That show that was on at 8 o'clock on NBC is not funny. You know what is funny? The show that was on at 8:30 on CBS. That show is funny. You know, they don't realize, well, that's your opinion. Okay? I fall back on if anybody anywhere laughs at anything, then it is funny.
Brian Regan's live stand-up special airs on Comedy Central on September 26th. Let's hear a little bit more of his comedy. Here's a little bit from his special from 2010, All by Myself. Speaking of customer service interactions, here he is talking about restaurants.
And I overheard the woman at the table next to us ask the waiter this question. And it's how she asked the question that was interesting to me. Excuse me, sir, is there any way I could get a glass of water? Is there any way? How many possible answers can there be to that question? Oh, ma'am, I'm sorry. There is no way. I toss and turn many a night, trying to think up some way, somehow, I could get glasses of water for customers. But I keep coming up empty. Legend has it there was a waiter here years ago who had figured out a way to do just that. But he's long gone, and with him the secret. It had something to do with a glass rack and a faucet, but no one's been able to put all the pieces together. So I must say no, there is no way. How I wish there was a way!
So I don't, you know, I know a lot of comics. I don't think it's uncommon for stand-up especially to be based on going through life and seeing things that don't feel like they make sense and asking why doesn't this thing make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that you are unusual in your commitment to making yourself the target of jokes. Like, mm-hmm. It seems like you have worked hard to focus on building a character who is, when I say a character, I don't mean that he's not an authentic thing about you, but a guy who is, just trying to figure things out and having a hard time, rather than a guy who's telling people the truth, which is a lot of stand-up comics approach to the same problem. And I wonder if that was like a choice you made along the way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it was a conscious choice, but it just felt natural for me to, I always feel like an audience is much more willing to go on your ride if you include yourself in who you poke fun at. You know, if you stand there and you're holier than thou, to me, that's not as interesting. That's not as interesting of an experience, for me as the performer or as an audience member. You know, I don't want to hear somebody behind a microphone if I'm in the audience coming off from a perfect perspective and showing how imperfect the world around is. I want to share in that imperfection. You know, like I want the audience to realize, hey, I'm a goof too. You know, I make my mistakes too. And so I think if I'm willing to poke a stick at me, an audience is much more willing to let me then poke a stick at the world, you know. I find it's a fuller experience, if you will, you know, because then you're including everything. You're including everything, including your own vulnerabilities. So, yeah, I like to, I do a lot of stuff about feeling stupid, but they're always exaggerated fantasies. You know, it's like I try to have the base of what I'm talking about be like a real thing that we all do. But then I heighten in my head and in my jokes how stupid I felt about that moment, you know, and something as simple as, you know, you too at the wrong time, you know, have a nice flight, you too. You know, I mean, that's a joke that I've done for years, but it sort of, you know, encapsulates, you know, what I'm talking about.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I want to play another clip from Brian Regan's 2004 special, I Walked on the Moon, one of my favorite bits from this special. So Brian is talking about Pop-Tarts, universally relatable food stuff, and how there are directions. There are two sets of directions on the back for cooking them. And he's talking about the second of those two.
Then they have a whole set of microwave directions. That just blew me away that you could actually microwave a Pop-Tart. I mean, how long does it take to toast a Pop-Tart?
A minute? If you want them dark? People don't have that kind of time. Listen, if you need to zap fry your Pop-Tarts before you head out the door, you might want to loosen up your schedule. And I swear it says microwave on high for 3 seconds. I don't think I want to wake up and be eaten in 3 seconds. The alarm goes off, put him in, ding, boom, I'm trying to get out of here.
I'll tell you what I really love about that bit, Brian.
Well, thank you.
It's a perfectly lovely premise, you know. Well, why are there microwave directions on Pop-Tarts? I love the phrase "zap fry," and I love the idea of loosening up your schedule to accommodate Pop-Tarts.
Yeah, thanks.
And I felt like when I heard that, I was like, either Brian Regan wrote down on a notepad at some point in his life, zap fry Pop-Tarts, or Brian Regan wrote down, why are there, you know, microwave instructions on the back of a Pop-Tart, and just spent a year trying out phrases, trying out little sets of words to describe microwaving a Pop-Tart. And I couldn't decide which of those I liked to think about more, but I wonder which is the real one.
Well, it's funny. On that one, the premise came first. You know, I like Pop-Tarts, and I was looking at the back, and I saw that you could microwave them for 3 seconds, and I just found that ridiculously absurd. So it started with that. But I think once you have a premise, I love just working on it and tweaking it and finding words and phrases that make it just a little bit funnier, you know? I go by this make something 1% funnier philosophy. So the premise itself works, you know, the 3 seconds to microwave a Pop-Tart. You can joke about that. But then when you do it from night to night to night, you go, okay, they're already laughing. How do I get them to laugh harder? How do I get them to enjoy this even more? So I try to find peculiar wording and phrases. I mean, George Carlin was, you know, the leader at that, you know? I mean, he loved words and phrasing, and it's fun to massage a joke over a long period of time and make it a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better, and you find a word and you go, oh man, that's a funnier word than how I was saying it yesterday. And some people don't notice the nuances, you know? Some people will see a joke that you're doing today as opposed to a year ago and go, oh, that's that same joke you were doing a year ago. And in my mind, I'm like, this joke has been through a journey that you're not appreciating, you know? But I guess that's part of it, is that the people out there aren't going to realize the effort that goes into something. You know, they just kind of laugh at the end result and don't realize the work that goes into it. But that's okay, as long as they laugh.
Well, part of the art of it is sort of concealing that effort, right? I mean, for it to feel like a conversation, even though the conversation has only one side.
Yes, it's very weird that, yes, that is the goal. You want it to sound like you're just kind of hopping on stage and you're there in the moment and you're thinking of these things and you're sharing them with the audience. But what's weird is when you get to where you're good enough at that, where people believe that and people come up after a show. I mean, most people aren't this naive, but some people truly don't know what a stand-up comedian is doing. I mean, some people will literally come up after a show and say, do you just come up with that while you're up there? And I'm like, wow. I mean, how could they think that someone is just thinking of this stuff off the top of their head, you know? So it's a compliment. At the same time, it's not, you know? I mean, it's a compliment that they feel that way, but it's like, they're certainly not appreciating the effort that went into me crafting all these words if they think I'm just winging it, you know? So, yeah, you know, that's part of the fun of it is, you know, all audiences sometimes care about is just laughing. They just laugh and, hey, wow, that was funny, and they walk out, and They might not necessarily know what went into that, but that's okay. That's part of the beauty of it.
You dropped out of college to be a stand-up, right?
Yes. Well, I knew I wanted to be a comedian, and I was 10 credit hours short of graduating. It was weird. There was a class I needed to get a grade in, was only offered in one semester and not in the other semester, so it would have been like this long, ridiculous journey to ultimately get my degree. And I knew I didn't need a degree to go audition at the Chuckle House Comedy Club, you know? So, and I was just passionate about wanting to be a comedian, and I didn't want to wait the length of time it would have taken me to wait to get my degree to pursue it. So I dropped out, and I what motivated me even further was when people would say, well, why don't you just wait and get your degree so you have something to fall back on if this comedy thing doesn't work? And I didn't want to think that the comedy thing might not work. I didn't want to feel like I had something to fall back on. I wanted it to work. It had to work. It was going to work. And so it was very difficult for me to pursue a goal that I didn't want to happen. You know, so for me to get the degree was for a life that I didn't want for myself. That was the safe route. So I was like, how am I supposed to wake up and go to class so I can get a degree for this fallback plan? I don't want this plan. I want this plan that's murky and weird and scary. That's the plan I want to go for. So I went that route.
When did you feel like it had worked?
Ah, boy. You know, there are so many little moments, you know. But I say to this day that the happiest moment for me was the night I passed my audition at the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Fort Lauderdale. I had auditioned 5 times, and on my 5th audition, it went pretty well. And then this guy who I had never met just walked up and said, "Hey, I'm Joe Mullen. I run the place. Can I talk to you in the back?" I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it, because I knew, or I felt I knew where this was going. And I said, sure. And he said, "By the way, I'm paying for your beer." And I was like, wow. Like it was such a milestone moment for me. You know, like when he said he was buying my beer, I knew that he was about to pass me. And I walked back into the kitchen with him. I mean, my heart was pounding. And he said, "Hey, man, I've been watching you, you know, over the last few weeks. You seem to got some good stuff going. And as far as I'm concerned, you've passed your audition." And it changed my life. Yeah, I didn't even know what that meant. Literally, you know, I didn't know what does that mean. I've passed my audition. What happens now? Does someone give me $1 million? But he was like, "No." He goes, "What that means is," I mean, I didn't say that to him, but he said, "Audition night was only one night a week. It was a 7-night-a-week club." He goes, "Well, what this means is you can come in and perform every single night, but you go on at the end of the show after the professional comedians. I let the locals," this is him talking, "I let the locals go on and do a few minutes at the end of the show." And I said, "That sounds wonderful." And I said, "I don't know what's cool and what's not cool." I said, "Would I be abusing the privilege if I went on every single night?" And he said, "I've never had anybody ask me that." He goes, "You want to go on every single night?" I said, "Yeah, I want to go on every single night." And he goes, "Go for it." So I went on every single night. Every single night I went on stage, and I just figured I'm going to use every opportunity I can to try to get better at this, you know. And this is going to sound corny and made up, but I don't care. This is the truth. He passed me. It was a wonderful experience. I was still living with my parents down in Miami, Florida. The Comic Strip was in Fort Lauderdale, so I had an hour drive home. As I was driving home, I saw a shooting star in the night, and I had never seen a shooting star in my entire life. I saw a shooting star just go, like right as I was driving. And I was by myself, and I was like, I couldn't believe the moment. I was like, this is crazy. I just passed my audition. This is what I want to do with my life. I've never seen a shooting star in my life, and I see it tonight, the night I'm told by a guy who runs a comedy club that I'm a comedian. So there you go.
Brian Regan, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you.
Thank you, Jesse. I appreciate it, man. I really enjoyed the conversation, and thank you so much.
Brian Regan's new stand-up special is called Brian Regan Live. It's the first live-to-air stand-up special on Comedy Central. It airs September 26th. Every week, we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. When it comes to music, fusion has a bad name. And for good reason. There's something to be said for just doing the thing instead of doing one thing with some of another thing and a bit of a third thing, especially if you're a newcomer to a couple of the things. But there are exceptions. Take Hugh Masekela. He started playing trumpet at 14 in a black township in South Africa. A few years later, he'd started South Africa's first black youth orchestra. A few years after that, he had to leave home. It was too brutal. The early 60s were a horrible time for black South Africa, but an amazing time for black South African musicians, at least the ones who could escape apartheid. Harry Belafonte helped Miriam Makeba into the world spotlight. Abdullah Ibrahim, then known as Dollar Brand, was a jazz piano superstar. And Masekela's hybrid of jazz, South African music, and American pop was making him famous, too. You probably know this song. It was Masekela's biggest hit and one of the greatest soul jazz records ever. It's called Grazing in the Grass. By the mid-70s, there was a new idea going around. World music didn't have to mean exotica. It could be more than American fads for Hawaiian bands or bossa nova sold to curious middle-class dads in suits. It could mean a genuine pop music of the world. Belafonte had been kind of the demo version. Bob Marley and the Wailers were the market proof. Hugh Masekela was then nearly 15 years into his career. He played straight jazz, got jazz guys angry by playing pop, played with and without the sounds of his homeland, but he wanted to do something bigger, something for the world. So he signed to Casablanca Records, the biggest disco label in the world, famous for Donna Summer, Parliament, and Lips Incorporated. Yes, Funky Town's Lips Incorporated. Masekela hired a Ghanaian highlife band, rented a studio in Lagos, Nigeria, and cut The Boys Doing It. It's a true fusion, a melting pot. It's sharp and focused and funky as hell. It was dedicated to Fela Kuti, the Nigerian bandleader who'd redefined African pop music by creating Afrobeat. Kuti's vision was always explicitly pan-African. He intended for his audience to be not just Nigerians in Nigeria or Africans in Africa, but all of the African people in the world. His purpose was to bind them together. With a blend of South African music, funk, disco, high life, jazz, and pop, Masekela shot for the same star, and he hit it pretty squarely. Masekela's trumpet remains front and center everywhere, and he sounds loose and free and fantastic. But listen in, and you'll hear lots of that lilting, jangling rhythm guitar. It's 100% high life. And of course, there's a beat. It's hard to get disco sounding this funky, but Masekela did it. I'm not going to tell you that The Boys Doing It is the Pan-African Blood on the Tracks or Thriller or What's Going On. But I will say that bringing all these sounds together, it's hard not to sound like a dilettantish doofus. For it to sound this good 40 years later, it's a pretty darn impressive achievement. That's my outshot. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Abadia Nexparello. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. Our thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. And thanks this week to NPR New York for their engineering help. If you'd like to hear any of our past programs, they are all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if you want to hear more about cool culture stuff in between now and then, check out our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. It's a sort of loosey-goosey roundtable discussion of everything that's great in popular culture, hosted by the brilliant and hilarious comedian Guy Branum. This week on the show, what Sesame Street's move to HBO means for public broadcasting, and panelist Oliver Wang's 10-year-old daughter drops by to give a kid's take on kids' TV. You can find Pop Rocket at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Pop Rocket. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener supported.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Support for NPR and the following message come from State Farm. As a State Farm agent and agency owner, Lakeisha Gaines understands the support small businesses need.
Every day, we get the privilege of helping people to recover from the unexpected, realize their dreams, and help manage the risk of everyday life. And for small business owners, we help them to think about all the things that are necessary so that they can continue to run their businesses successfully without interruption. As a business owner myself, I first reflect back to the experiences that I have. So we look at their liability. We look at their retirement. We look at the interruption coverage, everything that they need in order to continue to operate efficiently.
Talk to your local agent about small business insurance from State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Do you wish stories could unfold over 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? You tired of doom scrolling, trying to find humanity, or maybe a deeper understanding of why the world is the way it is? Listen to Embedded, NPR's original documentary series. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.